Now, Jeff Merrick, I know that you're a huge fan of modern music.
I am.
And you are no doubt aware of an artist by the name of Nicki Minaj.
I just discovered Tool like 3 years ago. That's where I'm at. So who is this Nicki Minaj you speak of?
Well, she's actually Maynard Keegan in drag. No, she's a hip hop artist. And more importantly, she has a hit song recently in which she repurposed the classic Sir Mix-a-Lot Baby Got Back.
Into
a song called Anaconda. It's a female response to the misogynistic ode to butts that was Baby Got Back. I tell you this story for one reason. Driving my daughter in the car yesterday, Anaconda came on, and part of the song is a sample from Baby Got Back, two girls at the beginning of the music video going, oh my God, look at her butt. And so in the song, it like matches the beat, and it's, oh my God, look at her butt. Now, you have children. Many of our listeners have children.
I have two children.
Four
yes.
years old is what? 4 years old can only be described as what, Jeff Merrick? A sponge.
Yeah, and you know what? Specifically, because I have a four-year-old boy and a two-and-a-half-year-old boy as well. TJ, our four-year-old. Everything is butt. Everything is butt. And you're right. Complete sponge. And everything is related to butts. Hands down.
Yeah. Poop,
like,
butts,
I'm convinced
farts,
that, Sir Mix-a-Lot remained four his entire life. I'm convinced. Everything with TJ is butts. That's it.
So you can understand where this is going, where all of a sudden now she's chanting along with the song from her little car seat in the back. Oh, my God. Look at her butt. But what became of it, though, was then every other song that came on, she would find a way to match it to the beat. So, like, Bust a Move by Young MC comes on in the car, and all of a sudden I'm hearing this beat. Oh, my God, look at her butt. And there's a part of me that says, wow, look how amazing the human brain is. That as a four-year-old, she can apply this lyric to different beats no matter what the song is she's doing it. And there's another part of me that's like, I just taught my daughter how to say, oh my God, look at her butt.
Yeah, and then what goes through your mind as a parent? Oh God, they're going to school armed with this. I'm going to get a phone call or something in the correspondence bag back, or you know, something tucked in the lunchbox. Great.
I'm happy you mentioned that, because like my first thought was like her teacher bending over to write something on a chalkboard or something.
Look at her butt.
Exactly.
We had a moment.
Or
we
God
had
forbid.
We had a moment with a 2.5-year-old Brody about a month ago, where like I have this thing about pickles. I love pickles, like full sour, hard sour pickles. I love them. Like it fills our fridge.
Just isolate all of that, please.
No, there's more coming. Trust me, Maddie. You're gonna want the entire soliloquy here from Hamlet. Stay tuned. So I'm trying to get I get this pickle jar out, and I'm having a couple of pickles, and the kids are TJ's doing like some junior kindergarten homework, tracing letters, and Brody's watching, I don't know, I can't remember what he was watching on the computer, probably Caillou or something. And so I'm eating this, and Brody looks at me and says, "What's that?" And I said, "It's a pickle. Do you want to try it?" He said, and he kind of gave me this look like, "I want to try it, but I'm not sure." I said, "Look, if you don't want to try it, maybe just lick it and see if you like it." And I figured it'll be sour and he won't like it. He shook his head and pointed at his mother and said, "Mom, lick Dad's pickle." That went on for about 2 weeks. Every time Claire would be in the kitchen, lick Dad's pickle. Kids!
Oh, kids!
The best!
Kids say the darndest things.
Yeah, like look at her butt and lick Dad's pickle.
Yeah, so
welcome to the podcast for a Monday.
Yeah, I was going to say, anyone who's heard the podcast can now completely understand these parenting techniques that we're both using.
Yeah, this is why Greg and I will soon grace the cover of today's Parent magazine.
That's right. That's right. Parents, and that's you. It's you and I in matching sweaters, holding cups of cocoa with little mini marshmallows in it.
Big thumbs up and shit-eating grins.
Hey, speaking of kids, one of the things you wanted to talk about hockey-wise today is the Pee Wee Triangle.
Is it just me or are we seeing this more? Now, when we all played Pee Wee hockey, what's the one thing that our coach, like when you first get past the point of, okay, the kids can now pass and shoot and you're starting to understand how to break the puck out of the zone and different, you know, different ways to play depending on the zone and zone positioning. One of the first things a coach will teach you is make triangles. Everywhere you go, folks, make triangles. And one of the most basic things you see in Pee Wee is that two guys behind the net, one passes to the other, and then they pass out in front, and it's a shot on goal. It's one of the most primitive formations you see in all of hockey. It's one of the simplest ones. Kids can grasp it. Is it just me, or are we seeing this almost every single game now? And it might just be because the nets are more shallow that we're seeing the Pee Wee triangle happen, but I think it was Nashville game last week. I can't remember. Was it last Thursday? Maybe last Wednesday. It actually worked, and I said to myself, that's a goal from Pee Wee hockey. Like what is now, it one of the is it one of like the unforeseen situations now because the nets are now more shallow, there's more room to set up behind and it's a safer pass because you can make the pass. A, the net's not there, no defenseman's going to chase you back there. Is that why it's happening? Is that where we're seeing the Pee Wee triangle everywhere?
I think that's a good theory. Are you also thinking of the Sedin to Lyndon Oive goal that we saw last week? I thought there was also one of those as well, where Sedin found him from back. It could be that. It could be that. But
don't know what
it
is, but it took me back to being a kid, and I'm like, holy smokes. That's like me when I was 11 or 12 or however old you are.
Yeah, but don't you think, Merrick, this is just what they always teach, what every coach teaches, which is fundamentals. Bringing it back down to basics.
It's, you know what, when that coach said we need to simplify things, we really simplified things. Doing the Pee Wee triangle behind the net, that is getting it simple.
Yeah. Fundamental hockey. We saw some fundamental hockey in the San Jose Anaheim game last night, too. Fundamentally violent hockey.
Yeah, it was a rough one. So I guess that's why John Scott's there. Okay, got it. Hey, how about Jackman getting second star?
Yeah, I know, right? Did you call Frank Saravelli and see if he switched his beat to Anaheim?
It was good, though. We haven't – listen, man, we all expected Montreal-Boston to be the first big fireworks, and we didn't really get it. And I think it was Elliot that was remarking on the weekend, like, hey, here we are a couple weeks deep into the season and no suspensions and no blow-up games. Well, a day later, we had our first blow-up game, and I think hockey is the better for it, to be quite honest with you. I think, didn't you get the sense of the first couple of weeks wish things were just a little bit too nice out there? That there wasn't enough salt. There wasn't enough salt on the rink.
Well, no, and I wrote about that over the weekend, of course I probably jinxed it because John Scott will get a suspension most likely for something in this game. But I said, hang on,
that's at the NHL's discretion, right? Because he came off the bench and went right into a fight.
And that's one where we've seen guys get suspended and then all of a sudden it's rescinded too. We've seen that too. That was the Bissonnette situation, I think. Where he came off the bench and then
to defend Max Domi,
rescinded it. Yeah, so that's a possibility. But yeah, I mean, no suspensions during the preseason, no suspensions through Sunday's games in the regular season. The only time we've seen a fine was for Milan Lucic having a stroke in the penalty box, if you will. That's the only, and of course the Voinov thing as well. So I mean, nothing on ice, and it's remarkable. But 165 penalty minutes last night between these Pacific Division darlings, and it was good to see a game like that. Now, some might argue the game got out of hand, but from a entertainment perspective, it goes back to something Aaron Portsline said last week on the show when he was talking about the Blue Jackets, which is that the Blue Jackets do their damnedest to play a Western Conference style of hockey, which means be as brutal as you can. And last night's game was a reminder that these guys, whether it's the Sharks or the Ducks or the Blues, maybe the Blackhawks if they need to, but to a lesser extent, definitely the Kings. It's not just that these guys are good hockey teams. They freaking bring the thunder, man. They bring the thunder if they need to in these games. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is fun. And you don't need, you know, Jackman and Scott to get it started either. Like, that's the thing that's really impressive. As much as, you know, St. Louis has Reeves running around, they don't need him to play that style of hockey. It still is, at the end of it, big. And L.A. is the best example. Sure, they have Kyle Clifford who can throw down, but, like, they are a large team that pound you, right? This is a large squad with large guys who get the puck behind you and put your face up against the glass. Damn it, it's fun to watch. Hockey to watch. Like, the Western Conference in the last few years have just been, it's just been so superior to the East, it's almost embarrassing.
Now, I think the Blues and the Kings and the Ducks all have that in their DNA. The Sharks always seem like this team that needs to import some of that. The Canucks tried to rewrite their own DNA by bringing Tortorella in, which didn't really work. But it always seems like the Sharks have to import some toughness. Have you noticed that with them?
In what sense?
You know, you bring in John Scott.
Yeah.
Like, I don't necessarily think other teams in the, you know, maybe because already St. Louis has a Ryan Reeves and, you know, Jackman's on the Ducks. Maybe they don't need to. But I don't know. There's something about the heavy hockey that the Kings and the Blues and the Ducks play versus what the Sharks do. I'm not saying there's a toughness gap. I just think it's a different kind of toughness.
So you're saying everybody else has homegrown toughness where San Jose's
got
to bring it in from the outside?
Yeah, they have to bring it. They have to, yeah.
I wonder if it matters, right?
It might not.
I think it depends on the personalities in the room. I mean, obviously, the Timber is led in St. Louis by David Backes, true or false, and that's a homegrown guy.
True.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a developed guy.
And then in Anaheim, you have Getzlaf, Perry, and now Kessler.
Getzlaf and Perry. Yep.
Yeah.
That's scary. That's scary, man. It's fun, Just let, you know what? Screw the rest of the NHL. Just let those three teams play each other the whole year. I'll watch. I'll watch every single one.
The California
screw
teams.
Everyone else. Yeah.
I think the CHL, the California Hockey League. I've been waiting years for you to say this. Now, obviously everyone knows that the power in the National Hockey League is in California, and everyone knows that the best hockey is played in California. I think it's a shame that the rest of the league waters it down. I think it's a shame that these extraordinarily successful franchises have to share their revenue with other teams. I think it's time that we just have a California Hockey League. Just secede from the rest. You know, let the Canada have their teams. Let the Northeast have their teams. We all know where the best hockey's being played. And I think that with a three team, maybe you could add an expansion team to even it all out in San Diego, maybe. Just a four team California Hockey League, and go from there.
Or do you throw Canada a bone and just let the Vancouver Canucks in there as well?
Oh, now you're talking. So you get Vancouver in the California Hockey League. Now, what happens when we expand to Seattle?
Oh, then Vancouver.
Then we go. We bring in Seattle and Portland. Okay, now we're cooking. We'll play for the Gretzky Cup.
That's awesome.
There will be a multitude of outdoor games. There will be one game each year played on rollerblades at the beach. That's also something that'll happen in the California Hockey League.
Have I mentioned on this podcast before how much I wish the NHL would invest in roller hockey and put together a roller hockey summer league? I think have I talked about that with you?
It would just be fantastic.
Oh my god. And now maybe just because I'm a big RHI mark, and I think you are as well, New Jersey Rock and Roller. But
Brian Trottier's team, I believe, if memory serves.
Oh, did he play with them or was it St. Louis? They played with the Vipers.
I think he played with the Rock and Rollers.
Playing the Rock and Rollers?
He certainly didn't play for the Orlando Roller Gators, sir, if that's what you're going to ask.
Ah, very good. Or the Anaheim Bullfrogs, for that matter. Thank you very much, sir. Now, do you think the San Jose Sharks yesterday were fueled by the angry, disgusted words of Jeremy Roenick the night before after losing to the lowly Buffalo Sabres 2-1?
As always, he is, of course,
Jeremy,
the
great motivator.
He may not be in the room, sir, but he's their leader. No, I think they were probably just overall disgusted with that performance against the Sabres.
Totally.
Came back out. By the way, commissioner for the California Hockey League, Martin McSorley, unless you think he should be player safety. So McSorley for player safety, who's the commissioner of the California Hockey League?
Oh, no, I think he's
Bruce McNall.
Bruce McNall would be ideal.
Oh, that's brilliant.
He'd also be perfect. The commissioner of the California Hockey. Oh, Marcel Dion. Come on. The original Gretzky in California. Marcel Dion.
Well, the Golden State Division, Pacific Northwest Division, and then everybody plays in the playoffs. They'll be called the Original Six. And
the real Original Six.
This is really a flawless plan. And eventually, when the league grows, then we do exactly what every hockey writer in North America wants, which is expand both to Las Vegas and Hawaii.
You know what's really interesting about this conversation? You and I, on days where there's not a lot of news, do a lot of bullshit talk, and we really have nothing to say. And it's funny, on a day where we just had a pretty exciting weekend with a lot of stories coming out of it, and we can only go 45 minutes because I got to take my kid to hockey. Here we are wanking off about the California Hockey League as if we had nothing else to talk about today.
you'd make the cup kind of look a little bit like like a cooler that you take to the beach. So maybe a beer sponsorship where you get a bunch of tall boys in there.
Yeah.
And fill it with ice. I like that idea a lot.
Cup celebration down Venice Beach, right by the steroid pit.
Right by the steroid pit.
Yeah, man. And then you surf with the cup. Come on, has a cup ever been on a surfboard? Has a cup ever been on a surfboard in the ocean?
Good question. I don't know. I don't think so.
Someone's got to surf in the NHL.
To lose the cup in the bottom of the Pacific would seriously trump Mario's pool, though, don't you think?
Get bitten by a shark, have that dent in the cup. Like, honestly, you wouldn't want to get the dent out if it was bitten by a shark, would you?
It's a flawless plan.
This is so
Vancouver
good.
And San Jose can finally win the cup. It'll be the Gretzky Cup, but a cup nonetheless. It's a flawless plan. California Hockey League. CHL.
Yeah, man. I'm down. I'm in. Sign me up. Let's have all those teams play against each other. Wild Rover Hockey says, we're not talking about Olli Maatta today.
We are going to talk about Olli Maatta. We didn't hit the intro yet. We're going through the frivolous bullshit before we get the serious stuff. Don't you guys know how this show works?
This is the
hook.
Can't
transition like that. Coming up, which Pittsburgh Penguin has a tumor on his thyroid gland? You'll find out after this intro. Oh, what do you need me to say the magic words? Let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
There is a battle for your consciousness, and you should never let that go. You are in charge of your consciousness and how you want to frame the world.
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
That's true.
Listen, Timothy Leary.
If you do start Dark Side of the Moon right now, it syncs up perfectly with the rest of the podcast.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Mark Cole with the intro today because on the official Merrick versus Wyshynski Reddit, the MVSW Reddit over the weekend, I noticed that while I get questions like, hey, Wish, post that chili recipe you keep talking about. Other people on the show get, I would really like to drop acid with Jeff Merrick.
I found that a little bit interesting. The first thing anyone really mentioned about me on our Reddit forum is, would you like to do psychedelics with Merrick? But I like that. I'm down with that. That's okay. And someone did point out, I'm just going to grab it up here. LSD and the really general category of drugs really shouldn't even be associated with your powerful stuff. When it comes to psychedelics, set and setting is so important. That's true. The benefits can be huge. However, it does need to be treated with great respect. If you aren't used to altered states, it could really be overwhelming. I know this is kind of random and pointless, but I feel like old J.J. Merrick would appreciate my need to clarify. Mm. That is true. 100%.
Indeed. All right, Olli Maatta news, as previously mentioned. Just they announced the press conference this morning, and no one really knew what it was going to be about, only that the team physician was there. And it comes out that defenseman Olli Maatta is scheduled to undergo surgery next week to remove a tumor from his neck that could be a low-grade thyroid cancer. The team physician says if it is found to be cancerous, we do not expect that he will need radiation or chemotherapy. We anticipate a complete recovery. In all likelihood, Olli will go on to live a very healthy life, and this should not affect his ability to play hockey long term. He's 20 years old. And once again, Jeff Merrick, 2 years in a row, non-hockey-related ailment affects the Pittsburgh Penguins' blue line.
Yeah, again, last year Chris Letang, this year Olli Maatta. And with all due respect to Chris Letang, you could make the case that Olli Maatta has been their best defenseman so far this year as well. Great that it's been caught. Hey, man, he's been great. And don't forget, he wasn't supposed to make this team last year, let alone stick.
Right.
Let alone be a significant contributing member. The London Knights last year were expecting to have Olli Maatta and Nikita Zadorov on their blue line for the Memorial Cup. Yeah, that didn't happen. And I got a chance to talk to him last year at the Memorial Cup. He was there watching the Knights, and he may be one of, if not the, not just brightest and most polite, but most, you know, down to earth and actually really smart and intelligent 20-year-olds in the entire NHL. We did like a little 2 or 3 minute interview with him, and he was A, not nervous, and which a lot of the kids are, but B, like, was, you know, when you're talking to someone and you can tell that they're not just trying to reach for the yearbook answer, but they're trying to understand what you're asking and give you a thoughtful response. That normally doesn't happen until someone's, I don't know, in their 30s or 40s. You know, dude's, you know, barely out of puberty, and he's given some of the most thoughtful answers you've ever heard out of an NHLer's mouth. So I'm impressed up and down the wall with Ole Mata.
Yeah, he was good in Sochi, too, in an environment that you'd expect someone to be a bit more overwhelmed. And
well, that's it, right? Yeah, no sense of
overwhelm. But he's never. He doesn't have a sense of that. He's a real solid, mature guy for being 20. But yeah, you know, speedy recovery, all that. It sounds like it's not going to be something that's going to interrupt that his career.
Did I read the press release right? He can play right up until he has the surgery. Am I right on that, or am I wrong on that?
I assume that you'd be right on that. I can't imagine why he wouldn't.
Okay.
You know, let's see here. What does it say? Mata has been cleared to play until the time of surgery, and then the doctor said he'll likely be able to return to the lineup within 4 weeks. So, plays up into the surgery, surgery out a month, and it's then back on the
ice. Always amazed me at, you know, how far medical technology has been able to help people heal and recover. And you always, you know, sort of think back to what this would have meant, I don't know, 40 years ago. And the frame that I always put around this one is, if we had, you know, the nature of the elevated and elite level of medicine and surgery and therapy and rehabilitation now than we did in, say, 1972, how great would Bobby Orr have been? Mm. Like, the things that they can do with knees now, if you could have done any of that with Bobby Orr, how long would that career have been, and how amazing would that career have been?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if memory serves, you don't believe he was all that good to begin with.
I love playing devil's advocate on that one. The watered down hockey.
Yeah, it's your
Bobby Orr.
To reset it for the new listeners, Merrick's Bobby Orr thing is sort of akin to people who question how good Mike Tyson was, because Tyson didn't have anybody to fight, and Bobby Orr didn't have anybody to restrict him from playing the way he played, correct?
That's the thing about Tyson is, too, he won fights before he got to the ring because guys were so scared of him by the time he actually, you know, got his towel off from around his neck. But the Bobby Orr thing, just to play devil's advocate on it, you know, you say to yourself, he played in that era where the NHL went from 6 to 12, and then two more teams came in 1970, and then 1972, and the league continued to expand. And, the WHA came in, and players kept getting peeling off. So if you want to be a smartass and infuriate people from my vintage, and certainly Karen Douglas, her vintage, who loves the Boston Bruins and the Bobby Orr, to say nothing of the Kitchener Rangers, bring up that little fact. Just say, you know what? He was the best in a time where hockey was the worst.
Yeah.
And just watch the fireworks.
The way you describe it when you talk about this is like, not only did we not have any Russians there, you know, but we also had it was like he was playing against a bunch of plumbers and garbage men from like.
Well, you know what's so interesting? Okay, you know when and
well, he was replacing players.
It's a bunch of like refrigerator repairmen. But when you look at the viz, like whenever Don Cherry shows, like, and this is what Bob Yora used to do, and you watch him like gliding through guys, maybe they might as well be orange pylons. Like, there was a whole lot of standing going on when in that era of hockey. Speaking of hockey history, can I detour really quickly on this? Because I found something amazing on the weekend.
Please do.
I think it's really going to perk your ears up here.
I will listen to this. Right now my mind has traveled to if Ole Mata went through this 100 years ago, and the press conference today was to announce a therapy of leeches and some sort of tonic
that's
cocaine
right.
in it.
We will be leeching him in the dressing room. He'll be fine for tomorrow's game. Just trot him right back out there. It's all pre-players association. Just be leeches, a couple of bumps, and get back out there, kiddo. Okay.
Brian Leach,
so,
Steve Leach.
Whatever. November 6th, 1983. You're a big Wayne Gretzky guy. How can you not be a big Wayne Gretzky guy? This guy was phenomenal.
I think I've stumbled across the California Hockey League.
Precisely, and the Wayne Gretzky Cup. 83 was a fascinating year for the NHL. That was the year that Gretzky had his consecutive point streak of 51 games. torched the NHL. The Oilers were fantastic, but something very strange happened on November the 6th, 1983. I want to give a full shout out to Stan Narodka, who's one of the researchers at Hockey Night, talking about this on the weekend in the makeup room, of course, where we have all of our hockey history conversations, me and Stan. And this is en route to his 51 consecutive games getting a point. The Oilers are playing the Winnipeg Jets. Final score is 8-5, Wish. And halfway through the game, it's 3-0 Winnipeg. Halfway through the game, Wayne Gretzky scores his first point of that game at 11:40 of the second period to make it 3-1. Gretzky scored 6 more points that game. Gretzky scored 7 points in half a game. Let the gravity of that thing sink in for 1 second. We've seen 7-point games before. Have we ever seen 7 points in half a game? Half a game. The first one was a shorty. Then he got even strength goal 5 minutes later, 2 minutes later, an assist on Kevin Lowe's, and then put up 4 points, 2-2 in the third period. All even strength. 7 points That's in insane. Half of a game. To my knowledge, I've never seen this recorded as an actual stat. The quickest to get 7 points in a game, but that's got to be it. There's got to be no one even close. 7 points in half a game? No empty netter in that one either.
Yeah, I have a feeling that's what stat they probably don't keep necessarily. But
well,
I think
someone's going to try to figure out who scored the
records.
Well, I know exactly, right? But I mean, there's got to be someone out there who said, I wonder who scored the most points in the shortest amount of time in a game. It's got to be Gretzky's 7 points in half a game. I'm guessing. 83 was interesting. When I go to the other Alberta team, a story I was reminded about last week that I wanted to get on the podcast, and it happened in 83 as well. Do we have time for this one? We're going to save it for tomorrow. How much stuff do we have for today? All right. Just because 1983.
We've got to talk a little bit about expansion. I want to talk about expansion fees. And then after that, go ahead.
Let's do it. No, because I got to punt it. I got to punt in like 15 minutes. Remind me to tell the Calgary Flames wheelchair story tomorrow, 1983.
All right. We're going to forget. There's going to be some shit that goes down tonight. And we're
no,
gonna
no, 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 no. So dude, someone on Reddit is going to be all over this one. Yes. Don't worry. Don't worry. We got good crew.
How much do you think an expansion team in Seattle would cost?
$250 million.
According to the Seattle Times and reporter Jeff Baker, and based on how much the Islanders sold for, based on the Ice Arizona purchase price, based on all of the things that he's hearing, he doesn't think, this is the actual quote, folks are kidding themselves if they think Seattle is getting an NHL team for under $400 million. Could you find someone to spend $400 million on an expansion team in Seattle? You might if they controlled the building, but that's the issue right now.
Yep.
Is that it's whoever buys a team at this point wouldn't control the building.
Yeah, they're a tenant.
$400 million.
That's a shocking number.
That's a realistic number, though, dude. It is.
Is it? I mean, I don't know that. I don't know that level of fine. I mean, you keep hearing the 1B floated around for another expansion team in Toronto, but $400 million for Seattle. Ooh, man! If the NHL can get that, that's a nice little love letter from Gary to the Board of Governors.
Pat Hickey mentioned I wrote about the decline of the Canadian dollar over the weekend, and I want Pat Hickey laid out a lot of different potential repercussions from it, and I think they're all legit. I don't think we're going down the same road it went down 14 years ago, because I think the league has just a shade more fiscal sanity, and I also think that the taxation of those teams were a huge issue.
The one thing that jumps out at me on that story specifically is it all depends on when the Canadian teams hedged. Like, at what point did they buy their American money?
Yeah.
Right? I would assume like MLS&E would have bought, would have hedged at a pretty high dollar. So they would be fine. I mean, that's always – and listen, again, I am not an economist, but this is something that someone at MLSC years ago once sat me down and talked to me about. So, look, this is how we do it. This is when we buy our American money. So when things like this do happen, i.e. the dollar taking a dip, we're covered because we've already bought our American money. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that most Canadian franchises would have done that. Even a small market like Winnipeg, because Thompson owns it. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say two interesting things about the story from that perspective is ticket prices. If they need to increase them, I'm sure they will. And as we've chronicled many times in the show, since seeing live hockey is crack rock to Canadians, I don't think they're going to miss a beat. Right?
In Ottawa, where you really have to travel to get to the games, that would be tough.
I don't care what the Canadian dollar is. Ottawa is a franchise that's on the precipice of trouble at all times. It just
Correct.
Is.
Correct.
Listen, for all the shit that the Coyotes people took for Glendale, how much more solvent would the Ottawa Senators be if that arena was downtown?
Oh, God, yeah.
Exactly.
100%.
Exactly.
100%. So, I mean, when Eugene Melnick bought the team, it's like the rink was a throw-in.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Okay.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like we always talk about the Coyotes being unsustainable because they, quote, put the arena in the wrong place. It's the same thing in Ottawa. It's the same situation.
Well, yeah. It's the Field of Dreams phenomenon that a lot of owners wanted to believe. Build it and they will come. Yeah, not so fun. Not so true.
Which is insane because, you know, all of the teams that moved into cities are doing better than they would be had they stayed out of cities like Washington, like New Jersey.
Here's a simple business principle. Go where the people are.
Yes.
Here's a clue. You want to sell to people? Go where they are.
Well, you see, that's the thing. Is like I think the Arizona – I mean the Coyotes people always were of the mind that the people would eventually go there. Like they thought the people would travel there regardless, and then eventually whole community would be built up because of that mega shoppingplex and the stadiums and the whole thing.
And that was a long-term plan for the city of Glendale.
Right.
That was going to be their Pied Piper, 100%.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, the other interesting thing Hickey said is you know, would declining value of the loonie influence the amount of money that Canadian investors would have to pay to get an NHL team? If the loonie is devalued to like 80 cents on the dollar, let's say.
Okay.
Would that affect how much money, say, it was a Quebecor would have to pony up to get a team in Quebec City?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I don't. I'd be as qualified talking about that as qualified as talking about Olli Maatta's potential thyroid cancer, which I have to Google quickly during the podcast to know anything about thyroid cancer.
Right, and also Olli Maatta's potential thyroid cancer would be a great name for a punk band. But I think I don't think it's going to scare away anybody investing in these Canadian expansion teams, right? Yeah.
No,
exactly.
Listen, ask anyone who's been in – I was talking to a friend of mine is in the investment industry, and he says, you know, any of my young clients, you know, when there's a dip like there was a few years ago and they only have, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 in the game, they call me and they're freaking out. Whereas I talk to people that have been clients of mine for decades – and I'll call them thinking I got to calm them down. And the opposite happens. They end up saying to me, hey, listen, it's happened before. It'll happen again. We're just going to ride it out. Take a breath.
Cyclical.
It's going, it's going to be okay.
Couple of games on Saturday I wanted to talk about real quick. Nashville and Pittsburgh. The Penguins go in there, thump them 3-0. James Neal held without a point. That's got to feel pretty good for Pittsburgh, don't you think?
Is that James Neal bobblehead night too?
Or is that the night before? I forget.
Was it the night before? I'm not sure. I'll tell you what. Listen, as much as I had serious questions about Nashville, and again, we're not even at the 10-game mark, so maybe I should have shut my mouth, they've impressed the hell out of me. And it goes to show you how much good can happen when you have the goalie.
And
that good things can happen. But long-term,
Laviolette's a guy who always manages to make a difference pretty quickly wherever he goes. It's always been his MO.
But do you buy the notion that the West is won down the middle, which is why ultimately Nashville may be sunk and Edmonton, despite the three wins, may end up being sunk as well?
Completely.
Then.
Completely. Because even if you make the playoffs, you're going to get your lunch handed to you when you start playing these teams that go three deep, especially like the Kings. The crazy pants 7-5 game with the Islanders in Dallas. There's a couple teams that are winning games in impress. Like the Islanders to win that crazy pants game, put 7 on the board. I mean, Lindback's terrible, but it's still really impressive. I really liked St. Louis.
Hang on, let me go back to Dallas for 1 second. Did you watch Friday's game against the Devils?
I did not.
It was the I'm sure you've been reminded about this on Twitter, the 18th game in a row that the Devils have lost a shootout. But in that game, and I've watched a lot of Dallas again this year. It's something really weird is happening with the two big acquisitions, Jason Spezza and Alex Hemsky. It seems as if Hemsky can't adjust to the speed of the Dallas Stars, which is bizarre for me, but that's what it looks like. And secondly, and we'll see what happens with his back over the course of 82, but Jason Spezza's flying. Sure, there are the turnovers in the bad areas, but Jason Spezza is completely flying out there with the Dallas Stars. He looks great.
But you hit on the point that's the most important point, is that what will those wings look like after he's been pounded by some of the big boys who are talking about
earlier. Don't know. But you know what? Enjoy it now. Just enjoy Jason Spezza right now, because he looks real good out there. And that blue line right now is playing better than they probably should on paper anyhow.
Yeah, liked the OEL game winner against Florida. Loved the Yager game winner against Ottawa. That was a game the Devils really needed.
It was a game
going to the third period.
Yeah, coming off the loss the night before. Mm-hmm. The back to backers, an emotional building for all the obvious reasons. The question I threw out there on Twitter about the OEL overtime goal against the Cats is there a better wrist shot in the NHL than Oliver Ekman-Larsson?
You know who I always thought had one of the best? Yeah, Alex Semin remains one of the best guys.
Very good.
On that list. Yeah. Tremendously good. He doesn't always hit the net.
here comes Semin's the season ticket holders duck when they see the wrist shot.
Yeah, well, you know, there was that thing where he took Capital Sands will remember this, in that that franchise-altering loss to Montreal in the first round that year. He took like 40 shots.
Oh, really?
Such. Yeah, it was crazy. Did nothing, but took a lot of shots.
So just at the end of it, it just had sore shoulders. That was it.
Which, by the way, sore shoulders used to put Semin on the shelf for about 2 weeks in Washington. I don't know how things are in Carolina. Three stars of the week: Jeff Carter, Ben Scrivens, obviously goaltending the Oilers back into relevance, and Franz Nielsen getting his first hat trick in his NHL career. That's kind of good.
Yeah, good for him. And that 70s line, maybe, is it still the best in the NHL? And is Tanner Pearson going to win the Rookie of the Year just based on playing on that line?
Actually,
when you want to talk about best wrist shots in the NHL, throw Tyler Toffoli's name into that mix. He's always had the big league release going back to the 67s, but man, that guy's shot is hard and accurate.
I mentioned this on a video I did for Yahoo last week. Like, as much as I love that 70s line, I have to admit that the Eriksson, Soderberg, Chris Kelly, Sweet Emotion line is pretty damn good. That's a pretty damn good name for a line.
That's a great name for a line. It's funny, with that, and it might just be because of a hand injury to Soderberg, but Kelly takes all the draws on that one and then shifts over.
Right now, your Calder, listen, we're going to have to start talking about these trophies, all right, because we're about a month into the season, and that's when we start looking at this shit. I know it's too early. I know everything could change. Just shut up. Tanner Pearson's got 9 points and he's got 7 goals. Damon Severson's got 7 for the Devs with points. And as a defenseman, if you're a defenseman and you're plus and you're within the top 3 in rookie scoring, you're going to get a Calder nomination.
He's the best. If you're going to ask, he's the best rookie in my mind that I've seen all year. Damon Severson, hands down. I'll take the New Jersey defenseman.
Philip Forsberg's got 7 points, only 1 goal. Yep. Again, the Calder's a very simple equation. You have to either lead the league in points or goals if you're a forward. You have to be in the top 3 in scoring if you're a defenseman. And you have to have gotten the majority of your starts and put up respectable numbers. And by respectable, I mean probably a goals against of maybe, 230 if you're a rookie goalie to get a nomination.
Yeah, I mean, just if you have a save percentage in and around like 910.
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. So in other words, Aaron Ekblad needs to be better than 2 points. He's played really well.
He has.
He's played really well.
Great.
21-54 on average so far this season, only playing to a minus one on the Panthers. He's played really well, but he needs to get the points up there if he's going to be in the conversation.
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
Yeah.
Philip Forsberg, by the way, a plus nine, along with Tanner Pearson, a plus nine.
Was my choice last year for the Rookie of the Year, Philip Forsberg.
Not sure what Martin Erath's plus minus is right now, but...
man. Haunt George McPhee.
God, do you think McPhee ever wakes up in a cold sweat thinking about the day he signed off on that trade?
You know, you get to a point where, as a general manager, I've talked to GMs about this before, you're sick of hearing, or you're sick of telling people that you have guys coming, that you got good players in the system. Right. You just want players right now. You just want players
but
now.
But he was always...
I can understand that knee-jerk frustration.
He was always so frugal in dealing with those prospects and trading prospects. And then he deals arguably their best one for a guy who is, I mean, at best, a third-line forward.
Well, it makes you wonder whether he, in his mind, and if so, he was right, he was worried about losing his job. And in his mind, Martin Erath was going to bring him closer to keeping his job than keeping Philip Forsberg. Does happen.
Cole wants to... Mark Cole is asking if we're going to talk about the ceremony Saturday night. It was awesome. The coordinated ceremonies thing was really, really, really cool. Really, really, really cool.
Yeah. The Senators and Devils at Center Ice... to me was perfect. Yeah. It was
right,
ideal.
Listen.
It really reinforced the message that there's hockey and then there's life, which I'm even embarrassed to say so, but always trumps sports.
We have to go soon, but we're going to try something different this week. Forgo the questions of the day and just have you send in mail. Now we won't do the sound effect now because you don't have time for it, but we're going to get right to some questions. Phil Coker writes in, okay, Greg and Jeff, but mostly Jeff because he's the MVSW Wikipedia. I've always wondered this and never really got an answer to it. Why is it players tend to pick jersey numbers based on position? Defenders often wear single digits, forwards double digits, excluding numbers 30 to 40, and goaltenders wear 30 to 40. Why? What's the significance or hockey history behind this? Seems arbitrary to me.
Well, defensemen just traditionally have always had lower numbers. And it started with the netminders who always had number one, and then it went out from there. Now they don't necessarily pick numbers based on their position, but they're based more on family history, superstition, a favorite hockey player. Like you look at the generation right now, what do most NHL forwards want to wear? 19. Because that was Yzerman, that was Sakic, like that. The number 19 has sort of become what I guess 9 with Maurice Richard has always been. Now there are certainly evidence to the contrary. Jean Béliveau wore number 4. Last time I checked, he was a forward. He wasn't a defenseman. Goaltender, we see plenty of Russian goaltenders who wear the number 20. And that's because they grew up idolizing Vladislav Tretiak. And even North American goaltenders like Eddie Belfour, who went to Vladislav Tretiak's camp as a kid, as a tribute, he always wore number 20 in his career. So it doesn't really go by position anymore. Otherwise, what the hell is Charlie Coyle doing wearing number 3 out there from Minnesota?
Right. And we're also seeing a lot of birth years, too. And you have to also remember that sometimes these numbers are also... they're also dictated by who is already wearing the number that you want when you get there. So some of these guys will reverse the numbers on the jersey if they can't get the number they want. They'll go one digit less. They'll go, it's a whole thing. It's not an exact science. One other question, I know you're right up against it, from Paul Goffberg. I think it's an interesting one. Alex Ovechkin is locked up until 2021 at $9.5 million per season, but what would he be worth on the open market today as a UFA? What would he get? What would his salary be or his cap hit be if he was on the open market?
What's the max?
It's an
right? Because he's one of those.
So?
If he wanted it, I'm sure there's someone who would pay him the max, and maybe that's Washington. If they had to redo the deals right now, And you ever play that game in your head that you look at a team's cap geek page and say, okay, let's say all these guys right now are RFAs and the general manager has to renegotiate all these contracts. How would it look? Maybe Washington ends up giving Alexander Ovechkin the max, because the one thing about Ovechkin too is people still come to watch him play. Yeah, not many people in the NHL that people come to watch. Like, how many times have we, I put out a tweet on Saturday after Ovechkin blocked that shot in the game against Calgary. And, a couple of people from Vancouver said, is he okay? I have tickets to tomorrow night's game and I really want to see him. You don't get that for every player. At all.
No. You don't get that. Right. It's a good question. The top actual salary right now in the NHL this season is Shea Weber at $14 million. Thank you.
Ed Snyder.
Offer sheet.
Ed
Snyder. Sid makes 12, Parise makes 11, Suter makes 11, Lundqvist makes 11, Ovechkin makes 10 in salary.
Here's my question.
If he hit the open market salary-wise, he would at least make what Sid makes.
What does Steven Stamkos get?
Maxed. He gets a max salary.
Does he get maxed by Tampa this July 1st?
That really all depends on whether or not he wants to be a star player in a wonderful place like Tampa Bay, or if he wants to be, and not many people get a chance to be this, Jeff Merrick, the savior.
Do you not think that right now Steve Yzerman has that contract in his desk drawer under lock and key and cannot break the glass until July 1st? But the moment he is allowed to, he pulls that contract out of the drawer and says, this is the max. This is yours. Please stay here. Because I can assure you, last thing Tampa wants is the Toronto sideshow all summer and then all next year before he signs.
It's real simple. If you don't want him to go to the Leafs, don't make your uniforms look like the Leafs uniforms. Psychologically, he's already preconditioned to be
actually,
a Leaf.
Okay, the colors are Toronto, but stylistically, does it not look more like the Wings? Like, it's a combination of the Toronto Maple Leafs and Steve Yzerman's old team.
What are you trying to say, Merrick? Are you saying that he's also preconditioned to go to Detroit? Nah. We'll have a ton of cap space available to sign him?
Da, 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 da. Stay tuned for that thrilling answer.
All right, listen. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
I got
longer shows later this week, obviously. Merrick's got to run. Love you all. Thanks to our guest. Oh, that's right. We didn't have one. See you tomorrow. Bye.
Our guest was Twitter.